Thank you very much. You are going to enjoy some free seats next to you, and just imagine how gracious you can be, because otherwise in our normal lecture theater where 100 people fit on, you would have the neighbor sitting on your lap. So it's very nice for us to have Ottmar Edenhofer here today, who kind of made our normal settings for our science and pretzel seminars not usable anymore because he attracted these large numbers. Thank you as well to the Melbourne Energy Institute, with whom we co-host today's seminar. And so Ottmar Edenhofer is the Deputy Director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. He is the Director of the Mercator Institute for Climate, the Research Institute for Climate Change and the Global Commons in Berlin. He is probably most well known for his role as the IPCC co-chair of the last IPCC assessment report of Working Group 3 with a quote, "It doesn't cost the world to save the planet." And he is as well professor for climate change economics at the Technical University of Berlin. So thank you very much. It's an honor to have you here, Ottmar. We already had very good discussions yesterday evening with the students, and so we have our Australian-German Climate and Energy College, where we have now 25 students, and we already had great debates yesterday, today, etc. And as well, Ottmar told me that I'm not going to agree with everything in the lecture. Now, if you look at the title, I just wanted to make a start here. I think the Paris Agreement is already a success. Yes, it is not everything that we need to have, the national implementation on the regional level, etc., that all needs to follow. But I'm very much looking forward to Ottmar's lecture, and we are going to have around 40 minutes of the seminar and then 20 minutes for discussion afterwards. With that, thank you for coming, and please join me in welcoming Ottmar.
Yeah, thank you very much, Malte, for this kind introduction. It's great to be here in Melbourne, and in particular to discuss important issues with my colleague and friend Malte, and also with his colleagues. We had already very exciting discussions, and one of the nice things with Malte is that most of the time I disagree with him in a very friendly, in a very productive way. And I have to say, the discussions we had over this week are enormously helpful, because there are a lot of differences between Australia and Germany, but there are also some very important similarities, for example, the coal issue. And I have to admit, I learned a lot over this week, and I'm enormously grateful to the organizers and here in Melbourne to Malte that he was able to make this happen. Now, let me start with one statement. I fully agree with Malte that Paris was an enormous diplomatic success. There is no doubt about this. An enormous diplomatic success. And to evaluate the diplomatic success, you could think about the counterfactual. If Paris would fail, we would be in a very depressing and in a very disturbing situation. Nevertheless, my lecture has two parts. The first part is very pessimistic. When I have achieved the maximum of pessimism, so then I become gradually optimistic, because I want to be pessimistic because I'm an economist, right? And economists have a reputation to represent the dismal science. The second thing is I come from Europe. You know, Europeans are always a little bit depressing. However, sometimes pessimism has its goods and its advantages, because in the end, I'm really committed to help make Paris a success. And from my point of view, it is very, very important that we keep the level of cooperation at the high level we have achieved in Paris. This is my intention here. So I want to be pessimistic, but I don't want to be unproductive and destructive. But let me start with my first statement. And my first statement is, and this is a figure, a slide from the IPCC report. And by the way, Malte said I was co-chair of IPCC, and this is enormously important for me that I was a co-chair, because now I am no longer a co-chair. I am a free man. I am no longer a slave of an institution. I can express my opinions, and please do not assign what I will say today to the IPCC or any other institution. And I feel very much privileged to be a free man and to use free speech, so all the democratic rights we have normally in liberal societies. So this is an enormous success. So over the last 7 years, I was always, I have to be very balanced and always very, I should at least try to nobody to bother or to raise any kind of hard feelings. So now, but today I feel as a free man and I behave as a free man. So, but nevertheless, I use sometimes a slide from the IPCC. And here the IPCC shows that over the last three decades, so we had even in the last decade an increasing growth rate of emissions. That's quite important. Emissions are rising and rising despite of the enormous diplomatic effort. So this figure shows the time path of emissions until 2010. And interesting enough, we have now a discussion what happened with the emissions after 2010. So, and there are two important interpretations. One interpretation is, yes, after 2010, almost around 2014, there are some indications that the global emissions might indicate at least a slower growth rate and even a growth rate of zero. It might be the case. Nevertheless, there are some papers showing that the amount of emissions which we can observe in China have to be a little bit updated. But nevertheless, even this adjustment shows that the growth rate might decline. But now it comes to a very important point. The important point is, are the emissions declining despite of economic growth of the world economy and in particular in China? Or are the emissions declining because there was also a slowdown of economic growth? So this hasn't been clarified yet. So we have to be open to that. But if this would be the case, that there was a slowdown of emissions despite of economic growth, we might see this as an indication of an ongoing decoupling between emission and economic growth, that this would be a good sign. I have to say I'm a little bit more pessimistic because I believe that the growth numbers are not totally reliable, and I would say it is not very likely that we see a sustainable decoupling of economic growth and emissions. Now, what is the reason for my pessimism? Now, let me show this slide here. Admittedly, these are also data until 2011, and I will then give you some indication why I believe that we should be pessimistic, not in order to be destructive, in order to make the whole thing a success. Now, what you can see here is that these are the four different driving forces for emissions: population, GDP per capita, energy intensity, and carbon intensity. And it's clear that population contributed to the growth of emissions over the last three decades. It's also interesting that in particular in the last decade, economic growth becomes much more important than population growth. And there are two other important drivers. The first one is the declining of energy intensity. And please have in mind that this is a global figure here. And this means energy efficiency has been improved all over the world, not just in Europe, not just in Australia, not just in the United States, all over the place. However, this energy intensity decline or energy efficiency improvements have been overcompensated by economic growth and population growth. And there is another component here. This is the carbon intensity. Carbon intensity measures the carbon content of one unit primary energy. So in the 70s, in the 80s, and the 90s, we had a decline of carbon intensity. Why? Because we had a remarkable substitution of coal-fired plants by gas-fired plants also all over the place. And this led to a decline in carbon intensity. But in the last decade, we have seen an increasing carbon intensity. which basically means that we start to carbonize our world economy again. Admittedly, it's a small part, but the crucial question is what will happen in the future, and therefore it is worthwhile to analyze the increasing carbon intensity a little bit more in detail. And here you can see on the right-hand side a decomposition of the carbon intensity. Now let me start to say that renewables contributed to the decline of emissions. So I do not deny at all the remarkable technological progress of wind and PV in many parts of the world. You could also say that biomass contributed to that, but these improvements in the renewable energy sector have been overcompensated by the increase of coal. And this is a very interesting aspect here. What has driven the renaissance of coal again? It was primarily driven by the power of the relative prices, which basically means that coal is much cheaper than gas all over the place, and many countries have been committed to invest in coal, not just the countries which are endowed domestically with coal. The coal market becomes increasingly an international market, and therefore there was a very strong push here. So the crucial question is, and this is something which we have, which has to be analyzed very carefully, what are the future prospects of coal? And I will come back to that. Now let me say a few words, and this is something where Malte Meinshausen and the IPCC have been enormously instrumental to make this message clear. So we have basically two focal points in two aspirational goals in the Paris Agreement. And this basically says it is a good idea and it is an application, a reasoned application of the precautionary principle to limit the increase of global mean temperature around 2 degrees. So the Paris Agreement said it should be well below degree. We should try to achieve the 1.5 degree target, in particular to acknowledge the climate risks of the small island states. Now, sorry, I would like to go back here. And the reason for that is that in the IPCC, we haven't aggregated the climate impacts and the climate damages in one single number, in one GDP number or whatever, because we felt this is totally, from an ethical point of view, inappropriate to come up with one GDP number, because this would imply that GDP is the most important welfare measure on planet Earth. It is not. And therefore, we have categorized here different risk categories ranging from unique threatened system like the coral reefs to the large-scale singular events. So what you can see here is limiting the global mean temperature around 2 degrees means to decrease the likelihood that these events might happen. But this does also say that even if we would limit the increase of global mean temperature around 2 degrees and even 1.5 degrees, this does not mean we can avoid all the risks. So we are basically living in a world where we have unavoidable climate change, even if we would be successful for any kind of mitigation policy. But I would like to add an important component here. So there are a few studies who try to figure out what is the impact of climate change purely on GDP. I'm not saying that GDP is the appropriate welfare indicator. Welfare, human well-being, is much broader than GDP. But here I would like to emphasize an important aspect. And this has been elaborated by people like Marshall Berg, and I found this very helpful. First of all, they tried to come up with a microeconometric insight, and they come up with a relationship between the annual average temperature and the growth rate of GDP per capita. And this basically says they try to measure the impact of climate change or the annual average temperature on labor productivity. And this means, and this is the advantage of this study, they do not take only into account the impacts of climate change on the agricultural sector. They try to include all the sectors, the manufacturing sector, the service sector. And it is astonishing how strong the variation of the annual average temperature on the manufacturing sector, on the building sector, really is. So they come up with this relationship where there is a kind of an optimal annual average temperature for economic activity. If it is too cold, it's bad for economic activity. If it's too hot, it's also bad for economic activity. I will not go into the detail. It is a very valuable, elaborated panel regression, very interesting. It has also its limitation because it does not take into account that countries can adapt to climate change. But it gives you a very important insight. And this is an insight where climate change has an enormous potential to amplify the inequality around the globe. Look at this graph here. Here you can see that according to this study, so Europe is not very much impacted by climate change. But at the same time, Middle East and North Africa is heavily impacted by climate change. Now, this is, from my point of view, very interesting to see, because it basically says that the already existing inequality between the region is amplified by climate change. What does this mean? Here I would like to make an argument about the limits of adaptation. So when I gave talk 5 years ago, for example, in Europe, I said climate change could lead to a situation where people might migrate from the northern part of Africa to Europe. What was the response, in particular by the politicians? They said, we shouldn't care about this. We have enormous government capabilities to deal with migration crises and migration flows. It's much better to do this than to care too much about climate change. Now, the attitude and the sentiments have been changed dramatically. Because the current migration crisis in Europe has clearly shown that even well-endowed and very well-established democracies came to its limits when they have to handle a migration crisis, which we have seen in the last 1.5 years. I would like to make this point here very, very clearly. There was a sentiment in the political circles arguing, okay, human beings are causing the increase of global mean temperature because they are burning fossil fuels and because of deforestation. There might be also impacts of climate change, but that's not real. So we can cope with that. And what I would like to make here is this argument that without overemphasizing the precise data, that climate change has this potential to widening the gap between countries and to induce some kind of reaction like the migration crisis, which are very hard to handle. And please have this in mind. This is a situation of unabated climate change, and it seems to me this is an important aspect. Now, the limits, limiting the increase of global mean temperature, this is one thing. And it is one thing to think carefully about the impacts of unabated climate change. And another thing, to figure out what are the implications for climate mitigation. And here the recent IPCC report was very helpful because it has shown that the increase of global mean temperature can be translated into a global carbon budget. Which basically means if we want to limit the increase of global mean temperature to 2 degrees with a reasonable likelihood, like 66%, so this has an implication. We are just allowed to release a cumulative carbon budget into the atmosphere. Or in other words, a little bit more metaphorically, you could say the atmosphere is a limiting disposal space for humankind. And this has profound implications for the understanding of a reasonable climate policy. Now, here in the case of the 2-degree target, 3,000 gigatons are available. Since industrialization, we have already used 2,000 gigatons, and roughly 1,000 gigatons are available as a global carbon budget for humankind. And this could be translated in a kind of an emission reduction profile by the mid of the century, between 40% to 70%. And here you might argue and say, okay, this is a typical IPCC statement, between 40% to 70%, this is a huge range, it's right. However, it does not depend on the uncertainty about the climate, it's about technological uncertainty, in the sense that the range is determined by the availability of a specific portfolio of technologies, which we have called in the IPCC the carbon dioxide removal technologies, which means technologies which would allow us to have negative emissions, to absorb CO2 from the atmosphere. So this is a very contentious and a very conflictual issue. So it consists of afforestation, a combination of biomass and carbon capture and storage, direct air capture, and so on. So I will come to that later, but so this determines, so to say, the emission reduction profile and the ambition by the mid of the century. Now, what does this mean in terms of technologies? And I would like to give you just a little bit an indication. So first of all, the basic message is this 2-degree target, or even to stay below 2 degrees, has a profound transformational requirement on the whole world economy. Here you can see two lines. This one is the business as usual scenario, which basically means this is what will happen without the climate policy. And then you have here a line which is consistent with a 2-degree scenario, what should happen. And the difference between what will happen and what should happen is the emission gap. And the emission gap has to be filled with some kind of technological innovation, like energy efficiency improvements. If you want to use the fossil fuels have to be amended by carbon capture and storage in some parts of the world. Nuclear power will play a role. But you can see also that worldwide, renewables are incredibly important, and also, to a certain extent, biomass in the combination with carbon capture and storage. Now, let me make another point. Here, I will show you now the global energy transformation pathway. And please look at this baseline scenario. Baseline scenario means basically it's without climate policy. So without the climate policy, without the climate problem, we would rely for many, many decades on the fossil fuels. Why? The reason is we are not running out of fossil fuels. We have plenty of fossil fuels. And I will show you in a minute that I also argue that we have an oversupply of fossil fuels. So without the climate policy, there is no need to transform. There would be no need to transform the energy system. So in the mid of the century and the end of the century, solar and wind will play a role. But nevertheless, so we would continue what we have now, a fundamentally fossil fuel-based energy system. Now, look at this. And this is, by the way, this is here primary energy. Primary energy, so this includes electricity, transport, heat, industry, and so on. So then we have a climate policy, and if you look at the climate policy scenario, it is pretty obvious that in the climate policy scenario, we need a profound and a fundamental change of our energy system. And if you look here at the electricity system, in the electricity system, this basically means before the mid of the century, we have to decarbonize our electricity sector almost totally. If we want to use fossil fuels, then we need carbon capture and storage. But the requirement is, in the next few decades, we can and we have to decarbonize the power sector. Full stop. Then it's not sufficient. We have to think about the transformation of the land use sector because we need biomass and so on. But the power sector is the first sector which we can decarbonize because of the costs. The abatement costs, the transformation costs are quite low because in the power sector we have plenty of options to decarbonize it. And this is just to show you and to give you an intuition. This is true basically for all energy systems. So in all regions, in the EU, in US, in China, we need these transformation pathways. In one way or another, all regions, all energy systems has to be transformed, and the same is true for the electricity sector. So the only thing is some energy systems might have a little bit more nuclear power and a little bit more CCS. Other energy systems might have more renewables and more energy efficiency. There's a degree of freedom, but basically it is clear they have to be decarbonized fully. Okay, and the same can be said by the sectoral emissions in the land use sector, transport, building, electricity, industry. And again, here, for example, you can see that the electricity sector have to contribute the largest contribution for emission reduction when carbon capture and storage is available. If it is not available, we need a lot of afforestation. And this basically means we have to take into account in our future decarbonization pathways the land use sector and in particular the agriculture sector. And this is one of the most important insights of the fifth assessment report, that we should not just think about the power sector, we have to think about a large-scale change in our land use patterns. Now, this is, from my point of view, the most important slide of this presentation. It's a simple one. So I told you that people like Malte Meinshausen have calculated that the atmosphere is a limiting disposal space roughly around 1,000 gigatons CO2. It's roughly. But for my purpose and for the sake of simplicity, it doesn't matter too much if you have 100 gigaton more or less. Because if you compare the limiting disposal space of the atmosphere with the amount of fossil fuels underground, so this is really mind-boggling, because we have 15,000 gigatons CO2 underground. And admittedly, we will not use all the reserves and the resources underground because of the increasing extraction costs. But even if we compare the 1,000 gigatons CO2 with the economically viable fossil fuel resources, we come up with the following numbers. 70% of coal, one-third of oil, and one-third of gas has to remain underground if carbon capture and storage is available. Why? Because if we have carbon capture and storage, we might have then underground an additional disposal space for CO2. I'm not saying that carbon capture and storage is a silver bullet. I'm not saying it is without risk. What I'm saying is, if carbon capture and storage can be scaled up, and it's a great if it can be scaled up, so then we can use a little bit more of the fossil fuels. But it boils down to a very mind-boggling number. 70% of coal, one-third of coal and gas has to remain underground. If carbon capture and storage is not available, it's about 90% of coal and two-thirds of oil and gas has to remain underground. So this has a profound economic implication. Climate policy means that we devalue the assets of the owners of coal, oil and gas. And this is not by purpose. This is just by implication. And in this perspective, I fully agree with Malte that the Paris Agreement is almost a miracle. Because all the people, the owners of coal, oil and gas, sit there and they agreed to the Paris Agreement. Now, if you look at this graph, what kind of options do we have? So I would like to discuss with you three options. Option number one, hoping for a miracle. As a Catholic, I believe in miracles. But as a Catholic, I do not rely on them. Now, what kind of miracle could we hope for? Now, let's assume tomorrow morning we wake up and we realize that the levelized cost of electricity of wind is so low that nobody has any incentive anymore to use coal. If this would happen tomorrow, technological breakthrough would help us. Because then, basically, fossil fuels are no longer an asset. Technological change made all these assets almost give them a value of zero. However, the problem is, it might be the case that in the future, and even in the near future, the costs of the renewables will come down So that nobody has in the future no longer an incentive to use the fossil fuels. The problem is in between. Because if we make the renewables cheaper, at the same time, we make the fossil fuels cheaper. Why? Because people are using more renewables and less fossil fuels. This leads to a decline in the fossil fuels, and it creates an additional incentive for other people to use the fossil fuels. So that's the problem as a transition problem. If we want to analyze a transition problem carefully, we should not just look at the costs of the renewables, the levelized costs of electricity. We have also to think about the costs of the fossil fuels. And the problem is that we have almost too much fossil fuels around the globe, so then we have to manage this transition phase. Option number two. We could say, okay, we understood that climate policy is fundamentally a supply problem. What could we do? We could say, okay, we compensate the owners of the fossil fuels. We compensate them and ask them to leave the fossil fuels underground. There are some proposals which are discussed now along these lines. So from a purely economic point of view, this might be efficient. It has severe distributional consequences, which might not be accepted by many countries. But there is an additional main disadvantage. And the main disadvantage is, if you announce that you would compensate the owners of the fossil fuels, leaving their resources and reserves underground, you create at the same time a strong incentive that they invest in the exploration of further fossil fuels. So, and this is something which happened in the last two decades, widely ignored by the public, the enormous technological progress in the exploration activities for the fossil fuels. So from my point of view, the only way to get rid of the problem is that we need, sooner or later, a carbon price which reflects the limiting disposal space of the atmosphere. I am not talking about just a carbon price to please the finance ministers. I am talking about a carbon price which reflects the limiting disposal space of the atmosphere. And we have to acknowledge the scarcity effect of the 21st century is no longer the fossil fuels, The limiting scarcity factors are the sinks, the worldwide sinks, here in particular the atmosphere. And we have to give this scarcity, this limiting disposal space, a price. Because only the price reflects the scarcity, and investors, entrepreneurs, and consumers can then respond to this increasing price. Okay, so far so good. For most economists, they say, okay, we have done the job. We are preaching the carbon price almost for 100 years. Obviously, the public doesn't understand us, and the politicians are not smart enough to understand our great proposal. So therefore, the carbon pricing proposal is not very popular in Europe, all over the world, and now we have to think a little bit more carefully how we can make the carbon pricing proposals work. But before I do this, let me come to the Paris Agreement again. Basically, in the Paris Agreement, we have two aspirational goals, the 1.5-degree target and the 2-degree target. And here I have an uncertainty range. And this uncertainty range is calculated not from 2011 on, but from 2016. And it turns out that in the best case, we have 200 gigatons available. In the worst case, basically, we have already exhausted all our available carbon budget, which basically means each ton of CO2 which we will emit now has to be compensated by negative emissions later. Now, look at the 2-degree target. There is also a range between 1,000 gigatons and roughly 400 gigatons. So it's a little bit better. So we have a little bit more intertemporal flexibility. And as I have shown you, so we have a reasonable chance to achieve it. However, if you look at the voluntary contributions the countries made, so this is, from my point of view, a reason for some kind of rational pessimism. Because what the countries provided so far, is basically to exhaust a remarkable amount of the available carbon budget. Again, in the best case, in 2030, 400 gigatons are available. In the worst case scenario, basically we have then already accumulated a carbon debt around 200 gigatons CO2, which basically means we need even more negative emissions after 2030, and we need a very rapid decline of emissions around 6% per annum, which is unprecedented in economic history. So this shows you that this is the basic challenge of the Paris Agreement: very ambitious aspirational goals, voluntary contributions which are not consistent with the 2-degree target, and everybody has acknowledged this, admittedly. However, and this is quite important, everything depends now on the ratchet up process, which starts now. And why I'm quite pessimistic about this ratchet up process is due to the single fact, if we look again at my coal renaissance issue. Now, what I have done here is I have calculated the accumulated committed emissions from the existing coal infrastructure and the new planned coal-fired plants all over the world. And I have not taken into account all the 1,400 gigawatts which are planned. I assumed in my calculation that only 1/3 of the planned coal-fired plants will become operational in the end. But if you do a rough calculation, this basically adds up to a cumulative amount of emissions around 400 gigatons CO2. So, and the renaissance of coal does not just stop in China. It moves on in India, in Turkey, in South Africa, and so on. So there are basically two interpretations of these numbers. First, the first interpretation is the INDCs are not consistent. The environmental ministers pledged and the economic ministers who are responsible for power planning, they are move on with their traditional decision-making process. And by the way, it's very interesting. It's indeed the economic ministers, because 60% of the planned coal-fired plants are in the hands of state. Okay, and here you can see the countries who are responsible basically for 90% of the coal-fired capacity. It's not, as I just said, China, it's India, Turkey, Vietnam, South Africa, Korea, Japan, and so on. And from my point of view, it is one of the biggest challenges, one of the biggest challenges after Paris, is that we keep the door open for the 2-degree target. Because when these coal-fired plants will be implemented, it will be very, very hard and economically almost not viable to reduce after 2030 the carbon emissions, because we have then created a massive carbon lock-in. And this is very worrying. Now let me highlight here just my proposal, and then I leave it to the further discussion. First of all, I believe that the INDCs are the starting point, and we could translate the INDCs in a kind of an implicit carbon prices, because this implicit carbon prices would clearly indicate what different countries have to contribute and want to contribute to the global public good. The next step could be that they implement some kind of policies, carbon taxes, emissions trading, or whatever, in their countries, so that they can get revenues within their jurisdictions, and I will say something in a minute how they can use the revenues, and the poor countries who are not able to implement a higher carbon price will get conditional transfers, for example, from the Green Climate Fund. And here it is very important for my understanding that we need conditional transfers. We should only provide the transfers if countries are willing to increase their level of ambition. So the ratchet up process is very, very crucial. Admittedly, the ratchet up process could be facilitated by the United Nations framework, but it could be also facilitated by an institutional framework around the G20. And let me say a few words about the G20. Because in the G20, there is now a very interesting political process. So the G20 is not primarily interested in carbon pricing, and it is not primarily interested in the reduction of the fossil fuel subsidies, which is basically the same as carbon pricing, because if you take into account in your consideration that on a worldwide level, we subsidize 1 ton CO2 at average with $150. So in that sense, we have carbon prices around the globe, but the carbon prices are very, very negative, $150 per ton CO2. So to get rid of the subsidies is enormously important. And to move on with positive carbon prices, it's even more important. But in the G20, people are not so much concerned about carbon pricing and the removal of fossil fuel subsidies. They are really concerned what they call an infrastructure gap. And there is an infrastructure gap for many, many developing countries in water infrastructure, electricity, transportation, sanitation, and telecommunication. So roughly $12 trillion per annum should be invested in the developing countries, not just to increase the infrastructure, but to provide the poor people access to that and also to increase the productivity of their own countries. And the crucial question is, what kind of financial means do we have to finance the infrastructure gap? There are a series of interesting financial tools, ranging from user charges for roads, land rent taxation for the finance of public infrastructure, private finance provided by the multilateral development banks, CO2 prices, reduction of subsidies in public debt. Very interesting proposals, and you could also argue, other taxes like labor taxes and capital income taxes. But if you do a careful calculation, you come up that by far the most efficient way, economic efficient way, to finance this infrastructure gap is CO2 pricing. And I give you just an indication here, what does this mean? So what kind of revenues you can generate? So this is a map, and the map shows for electricity, water, sanitation, telecommunication, and roads, and we have calculated, so can we finance a universal access to these services? And it turns out that a moderate CO2 pricing scheme complemented by a transfer scheme, which I have already mentioned, so a universal universal access to electricity and water, sanitation, could be financed almost in all parts of the world, except for roads, where in Africa and Latin America the cost still exceeds the revenues. And here we have only taken into account the CO2 pricing without the reduction of the fossil fuel subsidies or the rent taxation. We have done other calculations, and if we combine the reduction of the fossil fuel subsidies with carbon pricing and rent taxation, so there is sufficient amount of money available to do this. Now let me conclude, and this is something which I would like to highlight, and then we can continue the discussion. Now first of all, I believe that Paris was a spectacular diplomatic success. However, for me, the most important thing is the ratchet up process. And in particular, if we want to increase the level of ambition, the ongoing renaissance of coal is, from my point of view, incredibly important. And if I talk about the renaissance of coal, please have in mind, it is not sufficient that one coal fire plant here or there will be cancelled. In the end, it is a budget problem. And if all the coal-fired plants, even only a few hundred gigawatts, will be implemented, if they produce accumulated amount of emissions around 400 gigatons, so basically that's too much. It creates a too much carbon lock-in effect, which basically prevents economies to reduce emissions after 2030. And therefore we have now a time span of a decade. And from my point of view, the most important thing in this decade is keep the door open for the 2-degree target. That's my first message. The second message is, if we want to do this, carbon pricing is at least a necessary condition. It's not a sufficient one, but it's a necessary condition. And the carbon pricing should be also negotiated between countries, like in the G20, like in the UNFCCC framework, where we could use the negotiations about the carbon pricing also to amend and to complement them with conditional transfers. And the last aspect which I would like to communicate in my talk is finance ministers could find carbon pricing incredibly favorable, incredibly efficient, even if finance ministers are not particularly interested in climate change. They are not interested in climate change yet, but I hope that in the G20 agenda, we will find a way, an entry point, a short-term entry point, to convince them that exactly that the infrastructure gap is a challenge which can be met by a reasonable carbon pricing scheme. In that sense, I hope I started very pessimistic, and now I hope you agree with me there is some reason for optimism. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Please state briefly your name and affiliation. Yes.
John Frigga, and I'm an economist at the university. Can I get you to go a bit further? What you see is the best way to bring in the price mechanism? Is it a tax?
Oh.
Or do you want to go for an emissions trading scheme? And how do you sort of build in the story, as you say, this price has got to go up over time?
Yeah. Now, first of all, I have two perspectives on this. When I'm talking about carbon pricing, from the perspective of the United Nations framework, I'm agnostic if countries want to implement it as a carbon tax or as an emissions trading scheme. But from a European perspective, I have a very clear perspective on emissions trading. And if I'm allowed, I would like to make a few comments on this. Now, it is a problem that in the EU we have a malfunctioning emissions trading scheme, and there are basically two reasons. Here you can see this is the price trajectory for the future contracts and for the in the spot market, and it has been declined over time. So some people argue this is just an indication of the great success of the EU ETS system, because they argue the EU system delivered the cap, and if it delivered the cap and it is a price decline because of technological progress, it shows that mitigation can provide it at lower cost than we thought. So why should we be concerned about this? Now, we did an econometric study, and it turns out, and this is a quite interesting thing here from my point of view, that only 10% of the price decline are caused by what we call the market fundamentals, like technological change. 90% are caused by something different. And what's the difference? The difference is the destabilization of the expectations of the traders. And here we did an event analysis. And we ask ourselves, so how did the markets respond whenever the EU Commission announced a future policy? And this led all the time to a future decline in the market. For example, the backloading proposal, the market stability reserve, the announcement what will happen after 2020. So in that sense, this is very clear for me that the price decline was not driven, it's not an indication of a success. It is indeed an indication of the malfunctioning of the system, because we haven't been able so far to stabilize the expectations. Now, what's the solution for it? And that's the first thing. The second thing is, and this is something which is also, from my point of view, interesting. I mentioned that after Paris, there was even a further decline in the EU ETS, which is, at the first glance, a little bit counterintuitive. I have only anecdotal evidence and no statistical evidence why this happened. My interpretation is the price decline was fundamentally driven by the debate in Germany about the rapid phase-out of coal. Because if Germany phases out coal, it creates additional permits. Additional permits lead to a further decline in the price. Now, this is a problem because Sweden wants to impose a carbon tax. Germany wants to phase out coal. Poland wants to build up coal fire plants. So member states, despite of the agreed cap, have different preferences for climate and energy policy, which basically all the time disturbs the system. So in order to get rid of the problem, or at least to mitigate the problem, I strongly propose a minimum price in the European Emissions Trading Scheme, an increasing minimum price. So in that sense, if you ask me, I would be in favor of a tax. It's because of constitutional reasons in Europe not possible. We have to live with the EU ETS, and therefore I believe an increasing minimum price is the right way to go. Is the increasing minimum price agreeable? Yes, it's agreeable if the rich countries pay transfers to the poor countries. But this is already happening. Germany has paid to Poland a transfer that Poland accepts the market stability reserve. So the market stability reserve was totally useless. It has no price signal at all. So we paid transfers for the wrong thing. I'm just proposing to pay transfers for the right thing. So in that sense, it's basically similar like the international situation. We have the negotiations between the member states, and we have to agree on a minimum price, and we have to complement it with a transfer. In that sense, I would say we could increase the level of cooperation significantly. Now, I do not tell you a secret that carbon capture and storage, for example, in Europe is almost dead, no doubt about this. Nobody is interested in that. And the reason is partly social acceptance of the sequestration part. This was not accepted by the public. So we can discuss the reasons, but because from my point of view, the main reason was that the industry was not able to provide a reasonable risk management perspective on the whole thing. And my second argument is, so we do not know to what extent carbon capture and storage can really be scaled up, but one important requirement is, from my point of view, the carbon price. So without a reasonable carbon price, nobody will invest in carbon capture and storage. It might be the case that carbon capture is less important than we assume or we see in the scenarios. It's not an assumption. It's an endogenous induction in the models. But all these models require a carbon price. And therefore, my entry point is not telling, so let's invest in carbon capture and storage, but let's start with a carbon price. If you have a reasonable carbon price, so then it is up to the decision of the investors if they want to invest in carbon capture and storage or in other technologies. Because carbon pricing, I believe, if we are serious about the transformation of our energy systems, which is basically an economy-wide effort, we need then a tool which works really economy-wide. And the carbon price is, from my point of view, the right way to do. It is very hard to think about how to induce a carbon price in real-world economies, this I admit. But this is my first entry point. And then we can talk about the technologies, because the other way around does not work, that we build up then very complicated infrastructures, and in the end, we end up with nothing. So for me, for the next 10 years, is very, very important to find this entry point into the carbon pricing.
I just had a question in relation to getting an entry point. Given the political system
Yeah, of course.
Are there two more burning questions? We take them together and then we wrap up. The lady with the... Yes.
Can you say it?
So if we are to go ahead with us on carbon and governments and organisations do that green light, I'm saying how do you think they're well equipped to actually roll that large scale transformation out and implement it? That's
often. And then one last question here.
Have you factored in the need for direct change?
Yeah. Very easy questions. Let me start a little bit with the with governments and the transformational process. Now, one good thing, and this is something which is really helpful, because of the Paris process, governments start to think about climate policy and set goals. So that's a good thing, because we have now something to measure and say, these are the goals. Some of the countries, some of the INDCs are indeed not very precise, but some governments start to think about goals. But the problem is, and here you indicate to a problem, is that the political economy of carbon pricing is incredibly bad. So it's very easy if you want to have a transformational process to start with subsidies, because everybody likes subsidies. If you give one group a subsidy, the other group says, okay, I have also a good idea, I want to have also subsidies. So and this is in many, many cases leads to a situation where governments try to subsidize renewables, try to subsidize the fossil fuels, but in the end, you have a lot of disadvantages, because a carbon price is doing three wonderful things. First, it incentivizes carbon-free technologies. Second, it penalizes the use of fossil fuels according to their carbon content. And third, it generates revenues which can be used in a useful way. However, I fully acknowledge, so this is very unlikely, that this will happen without strong political leadership. And lobby groups are quite important, and it is a very tough thing. I have no final answer on the political economy side, because from a political economist perspective, it is always very, very hard to depart from the business as usual scenario. The likelihood of the status quo and the business as usual scenario is always higher. But it seems to me that for many, many countries, in particular because of this rising infrastructure gap, there is now a good time to think about such kind of entry points. And another short-term entry point, which could be incredibly important, in particular for China, is local air pollution. So, and because we have to find ways in climate policy where we can create benefits in the short term. It's not good enough from a political economy to say when we avoid the damages in the future and we benefit the future generations, we have to create benefits for the current generations, because we have to accept that politicians are relatively myopic. So this is not a fully satisfying answer. I know this, and I'm also struggling with a better answer. Probably next year when I come back to Melbourne, I have a better answer. Regarding the population and the other greenhouse gases, in particular methane, of course, this is included in the scenario. We have also population scenarios. So all the scenarios which I have shown have population scenarios derived from the UN population between at the end 11 to 8 billion. So you might ask the question, so that I talked so much about energy system and land use, why not talking about population growth and population policy? So first of all, what I would like to highlight is that population policy is much less effective in terms of mitigation policy, you might think. Why? Even if you would be successful to reduce the growth rate of population, when people become richer, even if they are less, they are consuming more. So in that sense, you have to find a way, also a new technological infrastructure. I have nothing against population policy, as long as it is voluntary. In particular, the best population policy we know is provide girls education. So that's the most important thing. It has multiple benefits. That's a good thing to do. But a good example is South Korea. They provided girls a brilliant access to education. They have been able to manage the population growth, but this does not necessarily lead to a reduction of emissions. So sometimes you need additional policy, and therefore it is justified that they have, for mitigation, a strong focus on energy and land use policies. Your question. Short, what was your question? Give me. Creating entry points and lobby groups. Yeah, basically, I have not a good answer, so I apologize. I come back next year, and then I hope I have a better one.
Thank you very much. Otmar, to continue a fantastic tradition between Europe and Australia, Europe is that slugging leader, or was the slugging leader, but very inert. Australia is this climate energy laboratory where we test different climate policies, throw them out, put another one in, and we can learn a lot about climate policy effectiveness and different designs. And the emission trading system that was implemented here in Australia was a better version of what Europe initially put on the market with an initial fixed price system, etc. And then Europe can again learn from the Australian experience. And today, Otmar is traveling back to Europe with something in a suitcase that is an Australian innovation. Some of you might have attended our previous seminar from Frank Jozzo, the regulated brown coal exit. It's not enough just to push renewables in. We have to think about mechanisms to get brown coal out of it. And maybe if you read the news in a couple of months' time, you will see that in Germany, such a proposal is going to be discussed, thanks to the luggage that Otmar now takes back to Europe. So, thank you very much all for attending. Thank you very much all for coming here, and thank you, Otmar, for providing such a comprehensive and very motivating thought with G20, etc., where the direction is going for the climate protection. Thank you very much.